The following Dharma talk was presented at Common Ground Meditation Center in Minneapolis, Minnesota, as part of the weekly Dharma series. The speaker is Mark Nunberg, guiding teacher at Common Ground.
Yeah, and it made sense to me, and we just finished our wonderful year-end retreat taught by Shelley Graff and Winfrey Key, and I helped out a little bit on the edge, we often call these retreats the sure heart's release, and it just makes sense at the beginning of the year, ending of the year, that we bring to mind what I was saying earlier, because, you know, these days, Buddhism, the Buddhist teachings are really... Mostly what we hear about is it in terms of stress reduction and managing our busy lives in a stressful world, and how much these techniques, these ancient techniques coming from the Buddhist teachings, are helpful, and how much now they've been integrated into Western psychology and so many other healing modalities wonderfully, appropriately. But it's not why the Buddha taught. I mean, it's a beautiful complement to what the Buddha taught, but the Buddha was really interested in the end of suffering. It's pretty provocative. And it should evoke a reaction, like, what do you mean, end of suffering? It's really appropriate. I'd be suspicious if we don't have that, like, oh, come on, we're humans. It's miserable being a human being. We're born, we die, and there's aging, sickness, and death, you know, and loss, and betrayal, and all kinds of power struggles, and all kinds of ancient oppressive systems that keep hurting, causing harm to people unfairly. This is our world. And then somebody comes around and says, there's a cause for suffering, and there's an ending of suffering. And, at least it should get our attention, like, what? You gotta be kidding. And I mentioned when I was giving the talk last night at the end of the retreat, you know, those kind of questions really evoke for us, point out what we have faith in. And honestly, a lot of us, we have faith in our misery, in our oppressed situation. We feel oppressed by illness, like I'm in the middle of some serious stuff, and it's oppressive, let me tell you. And I'm sure I'm not alone. You know, each of us in our own way, whether it's mental health issues or financial stress or medical crises or relational problems or just feeling moved by the tremendous violence in the world and injustice, wanting to help and feeling helpless. There's any number of ways to feel overwhelmed by life. And because that, those conditions that we live with, having a body, having relationships, having duties and responsibilities, having limited power, because it's a setup, a very compelling setup, it gets our attention, these dramas. And we have this particular relationship with desire, which is really, desire is, in a kind of Buddhist sense, is that current that I was talking about during the guided meditation. You know, when we relax and we open to our bodily reality, you know, which I wouldn't make too much of a point of separating bodily and mental and emotional. It's just what's moving here. And they're kind of just different frequencies of reality of our lived experience, gross to subtle. Mental being the more subtle, emotions kind of being in the middle, raw physical sensations being the more gross end of things. And these, just like the currents in the ocean, swirling, moving. And one of the ways to think about those currents is that it's really it's like a desiring, a movement of the heart, a feeling in the heart. It's really the essence of what's moving here, a feeling. You feel it? There's a feeling and it's moving. That's what it is. That's what it means to be human. It's rich and it's subtle and it's gross and it's ever-changing. And part of that movement of feeling is habits, very deeply entrenched habits of what we think that feeling, that movement is. You know, in simple terms, we think it's me or personal. And that sets in motion all kinds of, you know, strategies that has all kinds of implications for suffering. And the setup is that the wrong understanding of desire. So it's not, the problem isn't that current of desire, because that's just synonymous with being human, being alive, having a life, having sensitivity. For all living sentient creatures, probably, you know, to some degree in different ways, of course. We've got this current moving. And then to some degree, we have this misunderstanding, especially humans with the more sophisticated language and meaning. You know, we've got these ways that we construct a meaning around stuff. So we make up stories about that current of feeling, of desire. And we create this oppressive thing. Like, I got to do something about my desires. So much of what the Buddha's path is this understanding that ignorance, that wrong understanding of desire, has to cease. We have to let it die. And there's a mechanism, tried and true mechanism, for that wrong understanding of desire to cease, to end. The ending of craving. That's how the Buddha defines nibbana, nirvana, nibbana, release, unprovoked awareness release, the deathless freedom. It's when the heart realizes this freedom from wrong understanding, freedom from wrongly understanding the current of desire. So it's liberated from ignorance. It's the only thing that has to be released, ignorance and the suffering that arises from ignorance. Some of you remember, way back when I was a grad student, learning about educational psychology, we read a book a lot of you know about, Paulo Freire, Pedagogy of the Oppressed. I'm not sure when it was written, maybe late 60s or 70s. I think South American kind of liberation psychology, and it's kitty cat, sweetheart, not here. And what he realized, this philosopher, social activist, that what people realized for a long time, that if we're going to help anybody, especially those of us, which means all of us, who have oppressive mentality, you know, this is true around patriarchy, sexism, class, racism. You know, we embed ideas of, you know, better than, worse than, all kinds of in Buddhist terms, conceits, they get embedded in our mind and we're trapped in these oppressive things. So we have to liberate ourselves from these ideas, these ways that our mind gets established. And so that, in a funny way, a pleasure to see all the little and bigger ways that our mind is attracted. It's like a kind of home, but it's a very unhealthy home. You can call it a home that has the quality of fear or oppression or limitation or less than. But you know, it's also very oppressive to think we're better than, have to be better than, or disconnected in different ways. But there's maybe infinite, but many, many of these patterns that exist, each somewhat distinct to our own conditioning, our own backgrounds, our own lived experience, how we've been taken advantage of, and how we've had privilege. That shapes our mind, but it's all oppressive, whether we're living one of the more privileged existences or one of the most marginalized, oppressed existences. We're oppressed by our conditions. And we have every incentive and hopefully the supports needed to begin to let that ignorance die. And like I said, there's a tried and true methodology, which is opening, right? It's like a feeling, letting things move. And we start to feel the constraints and limitations. We feel the knots. We feel the tightness. We feel the heaviness. You know, the word dukkha is a really good word. We often don't translate it. When it does get translated, it gets translated badly as suffering, or stress is a little better maybe, unsatisfactoriness. But it has very subtle connotations of any kind of limitation. So the opposite of dukkha is like unbounded, released from all binds, all that binds us, like a free fall, non-abiding, the mind, the heart, not needing to be established in anything and anywhere. As the great teacher Ajahn Chah said, it's not about going forward, making something happen, not about backing away, not about standing still. It's really about non-abiding. It's about release. This is the radical message from the Buddhist teachings. And it's really appropriate. Our response now should be, well, I don't know that experience. That's actually, for most of us, the appropriate, oh yeah, I don't know that experience of release, of non-abiding. I know that experience of my mind wanting to be positioned, wanting to be in a good place, wanting to avoid being in a bad place. Oh, don't we? We know that endless struggle of trying to get from feeling in a tight place or an oppressed place to wanting to be in a looser, more open, nicer, more pleasant place. That's kind of the worldly territory we know well, right? From tension to release. So we know something. We know the difference between tension and release. We know something about the direction. But even being the person who needs release is not that non-abiding, is not the release. It's still, we're still trapped in that dualistic, I'm tight, I'm oppressed by my particular circumstances. I can imagine better circumstances. Now, I'm not belittling this. This is just kind of ordinary human management of our existential situation. We're all doing this. We're going to keep doing this. We're not supposed to stop doing this. But it can't be the sum total of our lives. You know, the struggle for comfort, basically. Even in wholesome sense, you know, struggle to have wholesome relationships and good way to earn a living without causing harm and all these appropriate things for humans to struggle with, you know, to kind of make life work a little better. But if we're fortunate enough, if we're not completely overwhelmed by the difficulties in life, then we want to consider not just taking care of that business of life to make things better, but really sensing the possibility of a freedom that's unprovoked, that's not dependent on my conditions, my health, my relational status, my financial status, my whatever status, being different. And we have to directly explore this. This is our practice. This is the deep end of practice. And it's, like I said at the beginning and during the guided sit, it really starts with, however feeble it might seem to you, it starts with some intuition, some confidence that we have to build. And initially, you might have to borrow confidence from your teachers, from me, from the Buddha, from whoever you can draw it from, teachings, that there is a possibility of real freedom, just enough to be interested. Because we have to look here and now for that freedom. If we don't look, we don't find. And if we look with our normal eyes, you know, the eyes of oppression, the eyes of our conditioning, we're just going to keep seeing what we've seen before, which is, I've got some difficulties in my life I've got to take care of. I've got to take care of this first, and then I've got to take care of that. And then, of course, that will never end. Those ordinary human things about aging and sickness and paying the bills and making amends with our relationships and trying to help others, it's not going to go away. So it's like, while we're doing all that ordinary stuff, not ignoring it, we want this intuition about freedom. We want to be interested in being free, released. We want to sense that possibility. And it's about the business of life happening on its own. So we feed the body, we use the toilet, we call a friend, we donate money to Doctors Without Borders. You know, we do all the things we do, but the mind doesn't have to be fixed, doesn't have to be unfree, doesn't need to be burdened. Even when we're doing all that stuff, taking care of the business of life. That's why there are so many, you know, poets and spiritual teachers. They use these naturalistic images, you know, things just happening on their own. Like the Buddha talks about rain falling on the side of a mountain, just how it naturally finds its way down. Streams and lakes and underground rivers and permeating the soil and these natural processes of cycles. And we humans, you know, because of our meaning-making mechanisms, we have all these very compelling dramas, we say, about how hard it is being me and doing what I got to do and making it all happen. And we get so familiar holding the world on our shoulders. It's scary not to imagine that we get the world on our shoulders. One of the great similes, some of you know Ajahn Jeff, Ajahn Tanisaro, a Western Buddhist monk, a great scholar and Dharma teacher, abbot of a monastery outside of San Diego, Wat Metta. But one of his Thai monastic teachers, I'm forgetting his name now, maybe Ajahn Phuong, had this great simile. It's something like, mountains are only heavy if you try to lift them. You know, so we can think of a story about my life and my problems, my life situation. And, you know, each of us, we have very compelling evidence about my life problems, my life situation, right? Each of us. And we basically create, or we imagine we have to carry that mountain of my life. Because that's what you do. You've got a life and then you got to carry it. You got to make it happen. And the thing is, we don't actually check it out. Do I got to carry it? It's such a unquestioned presumption that I'm burdened by my job. I'm burdened by this relationship. I'm burdened by this fear. Joseph Goldstein is a wonderful Dharma teacher, one of my very important teachers. But he tells such a great story, and you know, I don't know if you know, but he and Jack Kornfield and Sharon Salzberg and a few others started pretty young, you know, in the 20s, of course, going to India and practicing in the late 60s and 70s, and before they knew it, in mid-70s, they were kind of superstar Dharma teachers, even though they were quite young, figuring things out, probably still doing their best. Had some deep insight, of course. But, you know, still, like, I think all of us Dharma teachers, still practitioners, doing our work. And Joseph has this great story, you know, just in his personality, acknowledging this pattern of fear being just a big personality pattern. And he was teaching a retreat with Sharon Salzberg somewhere. I'm not sure when this was, maybe late 70s, early 80s, somewhere. And they were taking a walk together in a break during the retreat. And Joseph was just conveying to Sharon about how strong this pattern of fear was in his mind. You know, and this is someone who'd been now teaching probably for 10 years and had done tons and tons of practice and deep insight. And still, that pattern of fear was there, and in moments probably very convincing, like, this is me, this is my problem, this is my mountain to carry. And Sharon, you know, and their dear friends, of course, just evidently turned to him and said, Joseph, it's just fear, right? As in, it's just fear being known. It's just that feeling. It's just that current. And the mind is doing something. It's misunderstanding a natural current, a natural movement in the heart. That movement feels the way it feels. It's moving. It's not static. It's not some Joseph edifice that defines some entity in some kind of lasting, permanent way. It's a movement, a flow, which means it's not really what we think it is. It just wants to move, and it's going to move anyway. It's just fear. It's just that feeling, moving. Here and now, nothing behind it, nothing in front of it. It's just that feeling. Can this be okay? It's a really impactful moment for Joseph as he tells that story. And we all have our own version of this. I've had it a number of times with different flavors of doubt. You know, just really seeing, oh, just doubt. Just fear. Just anxiety. Just feeling less than. Just feeling greater than, better than. So this is what we mean when we talk about a mind that isn't established, a mind that doesn't have to abide anywhere, doesn't have to be fixed in anything. Doesn't mean we're not sensitive. It doesn't mean there aren't these strong, vibrant, intense currents. Yeah, there are. This is what it means to be alive. Lots of juice, moving, moving, moving. We want to feel touched and moved. We don't want to be afraid of the currents. But we don't have to make something up about them. We can just let the currents be the currents. Let them move. But we got to build this confidence. Like it's okay. It's really okay to let these currents move. I want to share a few things here before I end. One thing a friend, longtime Common Ground person sent in, Kathleen Z, sent in a passage. She doesn't know who wrote it. But there's just a beautiful image in it and I wanted to read to the group. This is a card she sent me during my illness. And it's just, again, it's just somebody wrote this. It had been a difficult time in my 59th year, loss, pain, demanding transitions, when a good friend asked, "Are you feeling as much impermanence and fluidity as it sounds like you are?" I loved her for asking such a question, for not only seeing me, but the larger landscape. I looked over her shoulder at the brilliant leaves drifting off the trees, begging for winter, and I thought, yes, that and more. I had grown weary from trying to sort my lot of catastrophes, from trying to make sense of events and turns, from imagining plans and backup plans. Out of exhaustion, I finally just opened myself to everything, not trying to draw any conclusions, but to receive it all the way the mouth of a river receives all the river carries, letting it mark and groove my bottom. This seems a better way to meet experience, not with ignorance or denial, but with a felt sense, but with a felt acceptance that this too will shape me. So I like that piece about not afraid of being shaped or touched. Let me just read that last part. I had grown weary from trying to sort my lot of catastrophes, from trying to make sense of events and turns, from imagining plans and backup plans. Out of exhaustion, I finally just opened myself to everything, not trying to draw any conclusions, but to receive it all the way the mouth of a river receives all the river carries, letting it mark and groove my bottom. This seems a better way to meet experience, not with ignorance or denial, but with a felt acceptance that this too will shape me. And then one last thing, something more traditional from the Buddhist teachings. The Mula Sutta. Mula means rooted. Rooted, R-O-O-T-E-D, rooted sutta. Sutta, like the word sutra in the Sanskrit, like when you get stitches, sutra, stitching together the teachings that point to the way it is. That's where that word sutta comes from. It's a discourse. It's the weaving together, right? The Buddha's articulating for us deluded folks the way it is. Right? The teachings are for deluded people like you and me. And we're happy to have them. So this is the Sutta on Roots. And the Buddha starts, monks, if somebody from some other sect, some other spiritual tradition were to ask you, in what are all phenomena rooted, right? So basically, if someone were to come to you asking you about the Buddhist teachings, like, what the hell is going on here? Well, what the monks said is, it would be better for you to answer that question, Buddha. So we'll listen. So the Buddha then answers his own question. Basically, this is what you should say to somebody when they ask, what the heck's going on? You know, like the nature of reality. And it's just a series of points, and I'll just end with this, because it's really powerful. And it's not what we imagine. You know, the Buddhist cosmological view is that all of this, what we sometimes call samsara, cycles of suffering, repeated, doing the same thing, getting the same results, pursuing desire, taking desire personally. So it starts with, you know, this is your answer to people. First, you got to internalize it, and then you can share it with others, right? All phenomena are rooted in desire, right? So you could say that all of this that we're experiencing arises, maybe a little bit more clearly, we'd say all of this is arising for us, each of us individually and collectively, because we misunderstand desire. We misunderstand craving. We personalize it. The whole world is born out of misunderstanding desire. Just stay open to that. It's not about like believing that. It's about having an open mind about what this is. And from a spiritual, existential point of view, this is arising because our heart misunderstands desire. And because of that misunderstanding, what comes into play is what we call attention, right? Because we misunderstand desire, this mind forms and pays attention. Because we have desire that seems personal, something I should do, something I want. Maybe you could take care of the camera. All phenomena have contact as their origination. So because of desire and attention, then we have contact with experience. Right? And we feel obligated to do something with contact. Because every contact, every sense contact, every sight and sound and smell and taste, we feel something. That's the next thing. All phenomena have feeling as their meeting place. Rooted in desire, come into play through attention, feeling as a meeting place, contact as origination, feeling as a meeting place. The mind organizes around that feeling, that samadhi, and we can then have some continuity of mindfulness, which allows us to discern what's going on. And this discerning process is we realize the mind is caught. But it's caught by feeling, misunderstanding feeling. And it's that turning, it's that ability to see the misunderstanding of desire, the fixation of the mind on that, the feeling, thinking I got to do something with the feeling. And it's that exposure. It's just like learning to hang out in that river of feeling, letting feeling reveal itself. That releases the heartwood, as the Buddha says. All phenomena have release as their heartwood. That release is natural when we let feeling be our teacher. All phenomena gain footing in the deathless. all phenomena have unbinding as their final end. On being asked this by those who have gone forth in other sects, this is how we should answer. So the Buddha describes a natural process. It starts with ignorance around desire. Then we let it kind of play itself out. Right? We have to let the whole samsaric getting caught, having feeling arise, misunderstanding the current of feeling, but establishing that samadhi, that stability, continuity of awareness, continuity of mindfulness, so we can discern, oh yeah, it's just that current of feeling. And then the whole thing unravels, release in an unprovoked way, reveals itself. It's not about you being good or you deserving some special reward. It's about hanging out, trusting, being right in the middle of feeling, the current of our life, the current of the present moment. We just have to have faith that it seems so innocuous and unimpactful just to be present. Like, it seems like we're wasting our time. Actually, that's not a bad marker. Like when you're practicing and you have that sense, I'm wasting my time. That's generally a good sign. Like, yeah, that just is, that's that ancient resistance to doing the practice well. Honey, just relax. There's something in this ambiguous, unfixed space of just letting conditions, letting everything move without a plan, where we're really exploring this non-abiding, this not trying to get to enlightenment or to get to freedom, but letting a natural process happen. There's so much in this about trust. I mean, it's intentional. We put ourselves in this position to trust. But nature does the work, not you, not me. If it's you and me doing the work, we're going the wrong way. It's just more self-centered activity, which only leads to entanglement. It's really exposing Buddha, being awake, is exposing itself to the way it is. So a lot of it is just relaxing and trusting that current, which is just the way it is already here. And now.
This talk, like all programs at Common Ground, is offered freely in the spirit of generosity. To learn more about Common Ground and its programs, or if you would like to donate, please visit our website, www.commongroundmeditation.org.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.